This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
Greetings this morning in His name. The topic this morning is living. One of the early church fathers said that the glory of God is man fully alive. And so, if that's the case, and Jesus came to give us life, then we have a place to go to help us understand some of that. So here's the angle I'm going to be coming from this morning. You as the teacher in the classroom are the largest influence in your students' school experience. You are responsible for the learning environment. The skills and methods you employ in teaching matter. Please continue to develop those skills. In the long arc of things, however, your character is of utmost importance. Your students will be shaped by who you be, not simply by what you do. The topic here is talking about students, teaching students to live, to remain alive, to make one's home in a particular place. And I like this part, person. Think about living as making your home with a particular person and suggesting that the way to be fully alive is to make our home with Jesus. To live truth, and truth again is reality, what really is ultimately Jesus, the fully human being who modeled the good life, fully living. How do we know Jesus modeled the good life? Well, he couldn't stay dead. That's pretty strong evidence. He was and is so alive that even death couldn't keep him dead. And so, fellow teachers, that's our hope. Not that our lives could be saved, but that they could be lost in order to be saved. Whosoever shall seek to save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve or rescue from death it. Jesus came to give us abundant life, and it starts now, but it will only be fully realized in the age to come when reality will be revealed. Is that good news? The subject is teaching students to live truth. What our students need is people to model that. Fellow teachers, the coming generation needs people of integrity whom they can put on a pedestal, people to follow, to imitate. How do we become worthy role models? It's not of our own strength, for sure, but there are things we can do in order to grow so that we be. Let's take a look at the life of Jesus. Luke 2, 48 to 52, this is picking up where Jesus and his family had gone to the temple, to Jerusalem, for the celebrations there, and they were heading back. His parents were heading back and realized their son, their 12-year-old son, wasn't with them. When his parents saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said to him, so they found him with the doctors discussing significant questions of life. They were astonished, his mother said unto him, Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress. And he said to them, Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house? And they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So we'd like to notice the well-rounded growth of Jesus. And this growth mentality is for all of us, old or young. If we're not growing, we're dying. And Some of these descriptions I want to give credit to Dr. Howard Hendricks' book, Teaching to Change Lives. So four areas of growth in the life of Jesus, according to verse 52 of the text. The first is in wisdom or intellect. So this is thinking about how we can grow to become more like our ultimate role model so that we can be role models for our children. So I'd like to encourage you to create and maintain a consistent study and reading program. Understand that leaders are readers and readers are leaders. Build your knowledge base. Take advantage of opportunities to build content areas. Hopefully you're getting some of that this week. The fact that you're here shows that you value that. Work to increase your capacity for thought and knowledge. Read books, study the scriptures, discuss ideas, let iron sharpen iron. Find the people in your community who are serious about thoughtful living. Get to know your students. Understand the needs and general characteristics of their age group, but then also get to know them individually. Second area of the growth of Jesus we're going to note is in stature. This is physical development. Take care of the instrument. The only instrument God gave you is your body. If you're going to serve the generation, the present generation, it will be with your body. This is often a neglected area, partially because of misshapen theology that compartmentalizes us and minimizes the importance of the physical and the physical body. Never mind that what we're looking forward to as Christians is the resurrection. The resurrection of what? Okay. Your body's going to resurrect, so it must be important, right? So how are you doing with money, with your possessions, materialism? Perhaps we could say that everything you have is either a tool or an idol. What about your diet? You know, if I'd be up here smoking, you would probably dismiss me. But if I'd be 50 pounds overweight, you would offer me more food. What about exercise? Regular, systematic exercise will likely add at least a few more years of effective service to your life calling. How about rest? Take care of your instrument. I know when you're 18 or 20, it can feel like it's something you can really beat up on. It's pretty resilient. It doesn't take long until you start to realize that our actions have consequences. Third area, favor with God, spiritual development. Spiritual development is a part of a larger process. If you neglect any one of these areas, it will affect spiritual growth as well. Your body, after all, is not going to resurrect in pieces. It's going to resurrect as one body. Okay? We have one life. Don't limit Jesus to some religious compartment and think that a chapter a day will keep the devil away. Favor with man. Social development. Friendships. How varied are your friendships? Do you have any Baptist friends? Catholic friends? Non-religious friends? Different age groups. I'm convinced we need to have friends from at least 1 to 80. Different nationalities and races. And you do need at least one close friend, hopefully several, who know everything about you, who will listen to all of your rants or crazy ideas without rejecting you, and can criticize you in a way that you'll listen. I realize all this might seem overwhelming. It seems overwhelming to me. You're not hearing it from someone who has arrived in all this by any stretch. But remember that the unexamined life isn't worth living. So I'd encourage you to start in some small ways. Set one goal or several goals of areas where you'd like to grow as an individual. I turn now to the teachings of Paul, one particular passage. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 9 to 24. This is in the middle of several chapters where Paul is talking about food offered to idols. And he has talked about how that as a Christian, he could claim rights and privileges. Here he's talking about what we might call a Christian athlete. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath. I think it was usually some kind of pine branches formed into a wreath. But we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. The discipline of the Christian life requires strenuous moral effort. The body needs to be brought into slavery, into subjection. Yes, as Christians, we could claim rights and privileges. But there is a greater cause, and it's the cause of the gospel. And that cause is so compelling that we are happy to release the rights and freedoms we could claim. Our rights and privileges must give way to the needs of the gospel. That means that many things the body wants to do, has the right to do, and is free to do, in theory, will be denied. You can imagine this message in Corinth was about as popular as it is in the Western Church of today. Thirdly, if you're getting in, then go all out. Why would a Christian leave the pleasure-loving society to get in this fight? The answer would be in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, the resurrection of the incorruptible body. It's important to understand that for Paul, the physical body isn't the enemy of spiritual life. It's the instrument of that life. We are stewards of this instrument. Temperance in all things, not a few select items. This is Paul's testimony. This is what I do, he says. There were seven cardinal sins, as categorized by the church, around 600. They are, and were, lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, and pride. These sins, at the root, are the human desire for more. They go directly against the commands of loving God, of loving our neighbor, respecting our bodies. The seven virtues, on the other hand, chastity, temperance, charity, diligence, patience, kindness, humility. Practicing these will guard against the seven vices. So the question might be sometimes, where is the power? Where is the power in our lives? Some of you are very skilled in some things. Probably we understand that if you wanted to become a master plumber, you would perhaps go to school for plumbing a bit. Perhaps you would apprentice under someone. Perhaps you would actually do plumbing for a long time. Perhaps you would go online and research the newest and best methods of plumbing. But if you kept that discipline up for 30 years, at the end of that 30 years, you would be a master plumber, right? Becoming a master gardener is no mystery. One must get educated, practice, gain experience, ask questions, learn from others, study, grow, experiment, year after year, day after day. Becoming a master carpenter is no mystery. Take classes, work on a crew, practice, all these things. Is it likewise true that becoming a spiritual giant is no mystery? If anyone believes and is baptized and practices the spiritual disciplines for 30 years, day in and day out, they will become a mature, stable, trustworthy Christian. If we're struggling spiritually, perhaps we're going to church on Sunday, we're going to Wednesday evening prayer meetings, we're going to the revival meetings, we're attending Teachers Week, we're listening to podcasts, we're getting a girlfriend or a boyfriend, we're attending Bible school, we're going to start teaching school this year, we're reading this book or that book, we're listening to good music, we're attending Passion Week or a Penn Valley seminar, or any other event that can produce a spiritual high. None of these things will produce solid, sustainable growth. We can try all these things, hoping it will fix me. We might get a fix, but these things in themselves will never fix us. Becoming a spiritual giant is not a mystery. Paul says, I keep under my body and bring it into subjection. What do you think the Christian training program or routine might look like for the Christian equivalent of an athlete like Tom Brady? Richard Foster, the author of Celebration of Discipline, offers three areas of discipline. I'm just going to mention them briefly. The inward disciplines, which he classifies, or which he names as meditation, prayer, fasting, and study. The outward disciplines, which he says are simplicity, solitude, submission, and service. The corporal disciplines, confession, worship, guidance, and celebration. Reading Richard Foster's book won't fix you or me. But 30 years of practicing the spiritual disciplines will have a significant impact. Perhaps some of you are thinking, this sounds like work salvation. I'm suggesting to you that practicing the disciplines simply puts us in a posture, in a position to receive God's grace in our lives. It's only by His grace that we achieve that posture in the first place, of course. If you're going to be an expert hunter, you know what you need to do. You need to shoot your bow 3 times a week for months before the season opens. You do your preseason scouting. You've got the clothing, you've got the scents. You need to get out into the woods. Need to have trail cameras. That's what I hear. Have we ever considered how willingly, eagerly even, we practice our hobbies? Would it be strange to suggest that there's a correlation between time and energy invested and outcomes? There's no magic potion. There's no silver bullet to any of this. We choose our lifestyle. Imagine having two dogs. One of them is fed every day. The other gets fed once a week. At the end of a month, if those two dogs have a fight, all other things being equal, who will win? Should we be shocked if after 30 years of working 50, 60, 70, 80 hours a week trying to make money and attending church every Sunday, that we remain spiritually impoverished? We are body, soul, and spirit, yes, but we are one. But there is the immaterial and material dimensions. They're both important. The material is eternal as well as the immaterial. Remember the resurrection? However, what we feed is going to grow. You can become a mature Christian. No one will become that without years of daily discipline and training. Many of us here are young. Hopefully, many years of fruitful service ahead. I'm suggesting to you that the productivity of the coming years depends upon, partially upon, the habits of discipline that you create now. You are a teacher. You are to model what it means to follow Christ in every aspect of life. You're never on vacation. I'm curious, how many of you have ever read Perelandra, the science fiction? Yes, okay. So I think about a particular, I think of various scenes in there, but one of them that I remember is, so Perelandra is a science fiction story where a gentleman comes there to visit. There's the green lady. This planet has never experienced sin. And so Weston, or Ransom, I'm confused, comes to visit, and he's speaking to this green lady who has no concept of sin and death whatsoever. But her presence is so holy, after the conversation he leaves, and it's just a little too much for me to experience that. He needs a little break from her. Like it's so intensely holy and wholesome that it's overwhelming. I'm suggesting you don't get to do that as a teacher. You never have a time off where you can just be undisciplined. Coming back to the passage in Luke 2. I'd like to now focus a bit on verse 51. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. Notice Jesus' posture. So the following verse talks about his growth, right? But how did he, what was his posture coming into that? It says he was subject to his earthly parents. To earthbound parents, children of the first Adam. That's amazing to me. Jesus here is 12. He's with them, as far as we know, until he's 30 years old. Notice his posture, submission to authority. Teachers, you are in a position of authority when you teach. In assuming the role of teaching, you are assuming a position of tremendous authority. Authority and responsibility always go together, just as do freedom and accountability. Teachers, as you move into authority roles, it becomes more important for you to be under authority. As your authority increases, your need to be under your authorities also increases. As your authority increases, your need to be under authority increases correspondingly. Teachers, seek out your authorities. Pursue them. They may or may not be people of wisdom, but often they have more wisdom than we give them at first glance. They certainly have blind spots. They will disappoint you sometimes. I'm one of those people, so I should know. Don't give up. We are called to respect our authorities when we're intentionally under them. If you as a teacher are intentionally under your authorities, you are in a posture to receive the grace of God in your life. Quite frankly, when I think now about hiring teachers, one of the things that is high on my list of characteristics is simply, how does this person function under their parents and their church authority? In fact, I can hardly think of a more important characteristic. Because you're in a position to flourish at that point. And I know we get it wrong. We mess up. We need to be leaders in repenting. Okay? Many of us didn't necessarily ask for the authority we have, even. Right now in your notes, if you're taking notes, I would like you to list the people you are directly accountable to. List the people you are directly accountable to. Who are your authorities right now? Who are your authorities when you're in the classroom? The Christian school is a ministry of the church. The school has no mandate of its own, has no authority other than what the church and parents give it. And so if you're in a Christian school, you must be under the authority of the church. Who are those people? Take that list and pray regularly for us. Ponder the quality of your relationship with them. You see, when I submit, when you submit to the people over us, those under you feel secure. Somehow they know that. They figure that out sooner or later. In the long arc of things, it matters. Incredible. And besides that, you are freer. Okay? So bless and pray for your authorities on a regular basis. In Luke 3, we have Jesus coming to John. John was baptizing people. And he asked for baptism. Again, notice his posture. And then in Luke 4, he comes to his public ministry in his hometown. And the people at first say, look at the gracious, listen to the graciousness of his words. Now, a few sentences later, they're ready to throw him out. But how did it happen, they're saying? How do we have a young man among us, among our town, who was this kind of person? We didn't know it. I'm suggesting it was because of his posture. Luke 6, verse 40. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. The King James Version uses the word perfect there. As a teacher, it is incredibly important. Don't hear me wrong here. It is incredibly important to teach reading, writing, arithmetic skills. You must do these and many other things. However, it's critical to be growing in graciousness. Students need the skills. They will catch the attitudes, the outlook on life. A few thoughts on how to teach students. Not many. Some of this is repetitive. For your younger students, teach them content, knowledge, build a fact base, stuff, lots of it. Get them outside in the dirt. Bring the outside in. Guide them in exploring God's world. It's unbelievably fascinating if you don't believe it. Just have Dana Atkinson come or go with him for a hike in the woods and you'll learn things that you never dreamt exist out there. Grow plants, catch crawdads and eat them. Dissect owl pellets, have a garden. The bees, the birds, the butterflies surrounding your school, well, maybe your school, maybe not, are infinitely more interesting than the latest and greatest man-made technology. Older students, all of that with an added dimension. What does it mean? I asked some of my present and former students about being challenged to think in school, and they gave me the right answer and said that they are challenged to think sometimes, thankfully. And I asked them, if they were, how was it done? And this is in high school. They mentioned a few things. This is just rather general. They mentioned particularly Bible, history, and literature classes as being thought-provoking. They mentioned being asked specific questions on worksheets. They mentioned class discussion. They also mentioned stories that help us see our own foolishness sometimes. I thought of two in particular. These are both in the CLE literature program. One of them is in junior high. I think it's called something like Chickens in the Mush. The story has to do with the feeder of the chickens with a bowl of mush coming into the chicken pen and dropping a spoonful of mush, and all the chickens rush to it and walks and drops it. And they all rush there and half the present. The previous spoonful is still there. And on. The other is, I'm not sure why these both have to do with chickens. I'm not picking on chickens, but the other is something about chickens. This is in the green book for freshmen and sophomores in high school, I believe. And it's the chickens in the wheelbarrow, something about their wheelbarrows and the bells and whistles and all that. And these both have to do with fads, actually, but it's just fun to see students read these little stories and look at each other. So there's good stuff out there to help them think, and sometimes you can work a little bit something in, a little bit deviously that is very close to home when you have those kinds of literature selections. After all, Jesus taught in parables, right? They mentioned questions that aren't resolved by one answer. It's not just one objective answer. He mentioned returning the question to the students. These are all basic teaching techniques. You know them probably. Student asks a question, ask it back to them. What do you think about that? And sometimes you can push them a little further and follow up. You have to know your students well enough. Some students will be uncomfortable if they give a response and then you say, well, so-and-so, what about this? So you have to know them well enough individually to know whether it's okay. Otherwise, they'll become afraid to offer stuff because the teacher's going to push me into something I'm not comfortable with. Questioning personal convictions. Why do you do that? Why do you think that? Sometimes this can be done in class. Sometimes it can be done one-on-one with older students. What do you think? Why do you think that? You need to know your students well enough to be able to ask them questions that they care about. And sometimes you may be having a routine class. You have your lesson plan, you have your questions planned out, but you realize suddenly that, oh, I got onto something there. They're with me. Look, folks, you need to have a plan. You need to be able to ditch that plan. If you have a teachable moment, just go ahead and have a moment, or several moments. I would suggest that when you are teaching, I'm thinking here with older students now, it is important to frame the issue. So, what is the larger issue, consideration, or principle behind what we're discussing? For example, students often, at that age, they may be questioning or maybe chafing under particular restrictions. You know, it really narrows my life down. And so let's say, for instance, that your church has a policy against the radio, for instance. So, well, what's wrong with the radio? Okay, da-da-da. And wasn't able to continue church fellowship because of something like that. And we say, how can that be right? How can you dismiss someone from church fellowship over a man-made rule? Good question, right? Here's where you can help them see that the particular rule is not the issue, but it's an issue of obedience. Okay? No one ever is dismissed from fellowship for the length of their sleeves or the color of their shirt. It's not that. Okay? So again, help them understand the bigger issue. Now, all of this can seem overwhelming, thus to me. It can be to students also. I would encourage you as a teacher, yes, be a solid teacher in all your classes. Teach the basic content, etc. But it can be helpful to choose a particular class that you will spend significant amounts of time developing with the intent to impact students beyond the written page in that class particularly. I'd like to close with a passage from 2 Timothy 3. Paul speaking here from prison to his disciple Timothy says, "But thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience, persecutions, afflictions. What persecutions I endured, but out of them all the Lord delivered me." Note his phrase, fully known. His student knew him, both sides, all sides, inside and out. He knew that Paul was authentic. Paul was for real. As teachers, we need to be willing to be fully known by our students. Teachers, we need to be willing to say, "Follow me as I follow Christ."
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.